Now 10 minutes after 8 o'clock, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's take a quick check on WGTD sports and weather. NFL, thankfully, the Packers beat the Bears 23-16 in Chicago. The Vikings beat Washington. Detroit beat Cleveland. Tonight on Monday Night Football, Miami takes on Carolina. In the NBA, the Bucks and Bulls both off last night. Tonight, the Bucks will host Memphis. The Bulls are off again. And over in the NHL, the Blackhawks lost to New Jersey 7-5. They're off tonight. Now that WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Should be a sunny and seasonal day today, a high of 43. The fog is lifting in the areas where there was fog this morning. Currently 29 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg. Next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to have two very special guests in the studio with me. First of all, someone who has been on the morning show before, although it's been way too long since we've had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Anne Gernach, a professor emeritus now of political science from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, retired, although only in the vaguest sense of the word, because she's been keeping busy with all kinds of exciting endeavors. And with her today is someone that she has known very, very well for a long, long time, Dr. Anna Mazurkiewicz, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Gdańsk, Poland. And Professor Mazurkiewicz currently is at Stanford on as a Fulbright Senior Fellow, and has come to Parkside to speak to several classes and to speak also to the public tonight at 6 o'clock. I think primarily about one of her most recent books, which focuses on some of the political exiles who came out of Poland in the years immediately after World War II, and what their experience was like and the kind of difference that they made in the West. But she is spending this hour with us to talk about her beautiful homeland and its complex and intriguing history and what might be ahead for it. So, Anne Gernach and Anna Mazurkiewicz, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much.
Nice
for
to be back.
Us.
Good to have both of you here. Professor Gernach, first of all, this is not the main reason we're here, but I just want to give you a chance to just say a quick word about retirement, in quotes, and all of the interesting things that you have been busy with in these retirement years. They've not been particularly quiet for you, I don't think.
Well, it hasn't been that long. I retired, I think I retired, I don't think so really, but in 2011. And in recent years, I've gotten back into my Polish heritage, and that's how I gotten connected with Professor Mazurkiewicz. And my parents were second-generation Polish-American. My mother was from New York City. So in my journey to find out where my relatives are from in Poland, I encountered Professor Mazurkiewicz about 10 years ago at a conference. And then I went to Gdańsk in 2012 for a conference, and we started this connection. And what resulted from that connection was an exchange that she's going to talk about between UW-Parkside and the University of Gdańsk. And then I was invited to teach there, and I did, about 3 years ago, I taught American politics. And I also have been teaching at UW-Milwaukee, and I've been also teaching at the OSHA, which is the counterpart for all here. So I've been really busy and doing some writing, but a lot of teaching, a lot of traveling. I just got back from Poland about 3 or 4 weeks ago, where I opened an exhibit about Jones Island, Milwaukee. And if you don't know what Jones Island, Milwaukee is, it's fishermen that came from Gdańsk in the late 1800s and started a fishing village in Milwaukee. So I've been bringing that story back to Poland.
Wow.
So I've been a very busy girl.
I guess so. And we're so glad that you've brought this this good friend of yours here and have helped to bring her to the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we welcome you again. Before we talk about what you are doing right now, and especially your research and your work as a historian and professor of history, I think it would be interesting for us to just find out a little bit about where you are from originally and kind of your early life, and at what point history started to become such a burning interest for you.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on your show. Thank you so much for having me.
Happy to have you.
I am delighted to be back at Parkside. This is not the first time that I'm here, but I was born and raised in Poland, and my parents, both of them originally are from the area north of Poland, which is southern Baltic coast. My father is Kashubian, hence the link to Anne. Kashub. Okay, it's an ethnic group, lives outside of the city. This is a Proto-Slavic tribe that lived in this area for thousands of years, withstood all the different boundary changes. They have their own distinct language. The only language within the boundaries of contemporary Poland that is recognized by the EU as an actual language.
And those were the people who immigrated to Milwaukee in the late 1800s.
They speak it, yeah. So
but
my dad is
a Kashubian. Not Polish. I mean, it's not pure Polish.
They have been living in the area for thousands of years, okay? So this is basically a group, an ethnic group within Poland. They speak Polish. They're bilingual. But to tell you, because you asked these questions, where do I come from? Well, I am from the area. Gdańsk is a city of migrants. The border changes. The political situation of my city has been very dynamic over the centuries. If you want me, I can go into that in a second. But my family is from the area for generations. So when I did the Ancestry.com test, it turns out I'm 90% Polish and I'm 9% Scandinavian, which is not in my family history. And it must be this interactions of the Kashubs in the area that gave me the Scandinavian particle.
Interesting. So at what point did you begin to be interested in history and some of the matters that you have taken up as a academic professional?
It's really hard to get away from history coming from Poland. This country had a very turbulent history. We were recorded for the first time as a country with boundaries in the year 966. And since that time, it's a history of struggles for independence, for maintaining our presence from a huge country from the Baltic Sea to the Black Sea to the small country that disappears from the maps of Europe due to the partitions in 1795, to the reemergence of the country in 1918, which we will be celebrating next year. It's going to be centennial of the rebirth of Polish independence. But my personal interest in history, comes from the earliest years. I was born and raised in Gdańsk, the city of freedom. This is the city that became Polish after the Second World War. In the interwar period, it was a free city under the mandate of the League of Nations. Before partitions, it was a Polish city, but because of the Prussian domination, it was predominantly German. So growing up in Gdańsk, I was already very much intrigued by the history of the city itself. But I grew up in the building in which Lech Wałęsa used to live. So the history of Solidarity just happened and was unveiled and covered in front of my eyes. I went to kindergarten with his schools. I went to primary with his sons and later daughters. I went to primary school with members of his family. When he was released from internment, it happened in front of my eyes. So when I enrolled with the University of Gdańsk, I wanted to write the story of how was Polish road to independence, because after the war, 1945, because of the communist domination, we were not a free country. So how was the Polish road to freedom in 1980s presented by the American media? So this is how I started off.
You wanted to know how we as Americans saw that, and especially how our media understood it or to some extent misunderstood it.
Exactly. Precisely because, you know, in the 1990s, the United States was not only presented as this beacon of freedom, as the alternative to the communist domination, but also as an example to follow. So I was really interested in the free media. I was also interested in American diplomacy from the, you know, foreign policy view. How did they understand the role of Poland in the region? Was Poland important for American policy planning for the post-communist world? So this is where I started.
Wow. And that's one of those fascinating topics you could probably explore for the rest of your life. This other focus, which is taken up in your most recent book, and we'll probably get into this in a little more detail a little later in the interview, concerns political exiles after World War II. Tell us what prompted your interest in this.
The story of the Second World War ends with the victory of the Western Allies. For Poland and the countries of the region, it does not end in victory because we are dominated by foreign Soviet troops, that being the Soviet troops. So as I was looking at the elections that were promised in Yalta, you know, after the end of the Second World War, we were left with three agreements by President Roosevelt, by Stalin, and by Churchill, okay? Then, of course, in the last meeting in Potsdam, it was President Truman already and Clement Attlee. In this agreement, the big three agreed that there will be free elections in East Central Europe. These elections were a total disaster. They were rigged, coercion, and fraud dominated. Some of the people who were in the opposition, who were trying to stop the communists from seizing the power, stayed behind and fought. But they mostly ended in camps, in prisons, tortured, executed, murder trials, and so on. When it came to the people who managed to get out, some of them were assisted by the Western diplomats. After I was done with my second book, I really wanted to follow their story. What happened to them? Did they go to France, Great Britain, to the United States, found jobs, and lived happily ever after? It turns out that no, they took on the assignment of becoming a surrogate opposition in Stalinist Poland. You know, the slightest evidence of you becoming an opposition, a threat to the government, would put you in jail. There are cases of people who not only lost their lives, but, you know, incarcerated families that were charged with spying for the Western allies, having nothing to do with not being able, for example, to speak English, right, and being in prison for being an American spy. Mm. But these people who got out, they were taken over. They got the protection, and they got the support from the American government. And they were given means and ways of communicating back to their homelands that probably would be interesting for you personally, because some of them started radio programs. In order to reach the captive audiences behind the Iron Curtain, they would prepare radio shows, not with propaganda, just giving information. Hmm. Not any kind of fake news, just facts. So that people in these societies where freedom of speech was non-existent, not even restricted, was non-existent, would have access to free news.
And there was no, of course, no free press under a system either.
Of course, no. Right. You would go to jail if you tried to write the truth about the regime.
Right. So this was the only means for concerned citizens to have anything close to a factual account of what was really going on.
Correct.
In Poland. And I suppose also was the only way for the people of Poland to know what concerned citizens on the outside were feeling and thinking.
Yes, but listening to the foreign radio, Radio Free Europe, was also punishable. Okay, mm-hmm. So it was dangerous to listen to the radio to get the true news. The rest of the people who got out, who are political leaders, former members of parliament, presidents, prime ministers, many of them joined their forces together. And I'm talking about the countries of the region, not Poland, Poland being probably the biggest and the most important, but in partnership with other countries of the region, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Romania, Albania, and the three Baltic countries that were turned into republics by the Soviets, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. And these folks, very brilliant men of different political background, from the socialist to the national democrat, they sat together and they tried to work a common stand on any major foreign policy issue and then promote it with the American government, with the United Nations, with the Council of Europe, and with the public at large. With the last one, they failed because they didn't have the means to reach the public at large, but they did get access to high-level government officials to promote the idea that Europe should be one and free, whole and free, and that the Soviet domination of East Central Europe should not be considered a status quo, that this is just temporary. And as far as this is concerned, I think they managed to convince the elites of the West that this was just a matter of time, that the communism is going to collapse.
For the sake particularly of somebody a little younger who might be listening to our conversation that might not know very much about the whole motion, notion of solidarity and the way in which freedom ultimately returned to Poland, just sketch how that ultimately did happen.
Solidarity is a phenomena. It's a social movement. It's amazing. It's not an opposition group. It's not just a group that has got an agenda and is rallying for support. It's a social movement that eventually, by the summer of 1981 and early autumn, before the martial law was introduced, and I'll get back to it in a second, was as big as 10 million people. And Poland is a country of 38 million people. That's a huge power. Solidarity came into being in the summer of 1980. And it's a movement that's, you know, was kicked off by a workers' shipyard strike in Gdańsk, where I come from. But its origin, its root, is deeper than just a workers' strike that was joined by the intellectual students and oppositionists throughout the country. 10 years earlier in Gdynia, the shipyard workers protested because just before Christmas, the prices of basic necessities like food went up, they skyrocketed, and the prices were controlled by the state. Mm. So that meant that, Christmas is a very special time in Poland, So people got really upset, so they started protesting, and the government was afraid that there is going to be a destruction of property, that the shipyard is going to be under lockout. So it sent military and police units into the city. It was said on the nightly broadcast that it's okay for the workers to return to the shipyard in the morning for a regular shift because the whole thing was over. They were going to back down from the meat prices increases. As the workers were coming to the shipyard, the military opened fire. And people were shot on the street, and this was the beginning of the understanding that this system cannot be reformed, that there's no dialogue. Because there was protest in Poland before. There was 1956 protest, worker protest for bread. There were intellectuals and student protests in 1968. But in 1970, when workers going to shipyard are shot on the street, that was the beginning of an end.
This can't be reformed. This has to be removed somehow.
There's no negotiation. This is not the government for the people, by the people. Right. It's an oppressive regime that kills the workers, the ones which the promise it represented. So when in 1980 the workers were on strike again, they decided that one of the claims, one of the demands that they had towards the Polish communist government would be to erect a monument to the fallen workers of 10 years before, of the 1970. So, and eventually they got the monument up. It's right there in front of the Gdańsk shipyard. The shipyard used to be called the Lenin shipyard. Mm. Well, now it's the shipyard of Gdańsk. But the three crosses in front of the shipyard are a grim reminder that this was not a joke. Because what happened in 1980 in the summer was, Petra Kenny describes it as a carnival of freedom. For a year and a half, people in Poland got this notion that if we are so numerous, if our social movement is so powerful, there are so many of us, and that the Solidarity Movement was able to push the government to come down and negotiate the agreement with them. The communist government conceded, the August agreements were signed. For a year and a half until December 13th, 1981, Poland had this brief moment where you could speak your mind.
Hmm.
It was a carnival of freedom, as I said before, and people believed that maybe we can make this work. Maybe things will get better. It was illusionary, and General Wojciech Jaruzelski imposed a martial law. It was a military crackdown of all democratic opposition activity, but it was not. Of course, it was not the end of the story. By 1987-88. Negotiations were resumed, and we ended up with the round table talks in the spring of 1989, which was a compromise between the communist government. Gorbachev was already in power in Russia since 1985. So, you know, communism was crumbling down, so there was a way the Poles could push the communist government into talking to them again, negotiate for the free elections. And although the elections were not entirely free in June of 1989, you know, for American listeners, this probably does not make sense. You know, you either have elections or you have a rigged elections. How can elections be half free? Well, Polish Senate was reinstated. Elections to the Senate were free. Elections to the lower chamber of Polish National Assembly, which is the House, had a guaranteed number of seats that were reserved for the communists. And this is how the elections were partially free. By August, we had the first non-communist prime minister, Tadeusz Mazowiecki. And that's the Polish miracle. For the first time, I guess, in Polish history, a major turmoil and the change of the governmental system occurred without a single shot fired.
Wow, yes. And that's something not to take for granted. And that helped change everything.
Hmm. You're right. It's something that people tend to forget. Poland has, since 2004, we are a member of the European Union. Since 1999, we are a member of NATO. Poland has not been as safe and as secure as it is now for centuries, and I'm not afraid to say this. But it's not to be taken for granted, just like you said. We have a powerful neighbor to our east. It's a very volatile moment in the history of the region where people are trying to redefine what it means to be a nation, what it means to be a member of a European community. It's a difficult time. I am worried at this moment as we speak. But
I know that that recently here in the United States were reports of lots of demonstrations in Poland, which point to a very sort of volatile political situation, maybe not all that unlike some of the volatility we are seeing here in America. Can you just say a word about what is going on in Poland right now?
We have a lot of disenchanted youth, people who are children of the families who really did not benefit as much as they had hoped for from the transition from the centrally controlled economy to the capitalist system. And I think this is part of the problem, that this transition of the country system, economic and political, did not benefit everyone equally. And this was something that, you know, communism proclaimed, like, you know, no matter who you are, where you're from, your chances and your position in the society should be equal. Capitalism, when it came to Poland, it was really a wild type. Okay. And I think this is one part of the problem. The second part of the problem is that Poland is not immune from what's going on in different places in Europe. nationalism is back, and it's not just a local phenomena. And I think it's been fueled by something that in the European media is called as the migration crisis. I don't really know if this is a crisis or is this the inability to, you know, come together and decide what do you do with the people who are seeking refuge from the regions. You know, it's hard to understand for a Polish person why should we support the Syrian refugees because they have no interest in the regions. But it surprises me, and I cannot really understand it, why a country of exiles and emigres and refugees as Poland was, and to extent, you know, as an immigrant sending country still is, how can they reject the notion that we need to help people in need? But, you know, country being safe, relatively prosperous, some people just feel like they need to keep it going as it is. Okay, they are afraid of any changes. And I think this notion also contributes to it. What happened in Warsaw yesterday, 2 days ago, I'm forgetting about the time difference, November 11th is the Polish, it's a holiday, a day of national independence. It goes back to 1918 and the recognition that there will be Poland again. After 123 years, Poland was back on the maps of Europe. Mm. And we celebrated only since communism collapsed. So it's a holiday that is new to our, you know, national tradition. And I think part of the way to celebrate this and to get the people together was to organize these street parades. For about 8 to 10 years now, this has been a site for volatile clashes, violent clashes between the people who are pro-European, progressive, liberal Democrats, and people who are, I think some of them are small, not important groups of people who are extreme right-wing nationalists. And they are sabotaging these demonstrations. So despite the fact that there are independence runs, marathons, despite the fact that there's this tradition of preparing little batons with Polish national colors to wear, there are children's competitions, musical concerts to celebrate the Polish independence, only this event gets the attention.
Right.
And it's played out big time. But I don't want to downplay the significance of what happened to, you know, on the 11th in Warsaw. This is dangerous, and this cannot be tolerated. There are very unsettling slogans that are being promoted during this march, which we need to speak out about it, and we need to confront the people who are trying to sabotage our tradition, our history, by promoting xenophobic, nationalistic, chauvinistic, and anti-Semitic agenda. This is not the majority of the Poles. No matter if you are right wing or left wing or center, doesn't matter. You know, this is ultra right, and we need to be aware that this is a dangerous group, but it's a small fringe.
Right. So this is an extreme fringe we're talking about. I'm sure part of what was quite unsettling to you and others in Poland, not of such a persuasion, was the fact that these appeared to be such young demonstrators. And of course, that it's easy to sort of leap to conclusions that this is the direction that Poland is heading because you're seeing thousands upon thousands of young people. But of course, what you're pointing out quite rightly is that this is just a small fraction of.
But they get a lot of attention, and they can quite skillfully navigate the waters of public discourse by promoting themselves as the young Poles. Okay, this is, you know, the young student, you know, and a person who is open-minded, progressive, again, doesn't matter, right-wing, left-wing, he or she will not take a red flare, go on the street with a mask of a skeleton, shouting to, you know, hang all and whoever, you know, they pick, you know, randomly. The problem is that we have a group of, you know, it all started with the soccer games. I don't know if you've ever seen a Polish soccer game. We are all passionate about soccer, okay? we love Robert Lewandowski and, you know, Artur Bogdan and others. So Poland is a big soccer fan community. But I do not go to games anymore. I'm afraid of the hooligans. And this is similar to what's happening what was happening back in 1970s and 1980s on the British Isles, right? So there is this culture or subculture of soccer fans, and they are really creating these clubs which, to a large extent, sometimes sabotage the idea of sports. Even the teams sometimes have problems with these extreme fans. But I think from this milieu, the notion of going into the streets with the soccer fan, you know, red flares, evolved.
Yeah.
It's. I don't want to simplify the problem, but these are, you know, the groups that started the whole notion of sabotaging Independence Day marches.
Wow. Fascinating, the way that the one might shift to the other. Wow. And very unsettling indeed. For those of you just joining us for the morning show today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Anna Muzakiewicz, who is Associate Professor of History at the University of Gdansk, Poland. And she is right now a Fulbright Senior Fellow at Stanford University and is today a guest of the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. And we'll call her faculty host is with us as well, Dr. Ann Gernach, a Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Well, it makes it even more important for us to understand the current situation and the history behind it and where it comes from and where it might be headed. Say a word about the work that you are doing right now at Stanford, and maybe in line with that, maybe touch on the fact that one of the things you teach at the university back in Gdansk is American history. And I'm just so intrigued, and it would probably be interesting for Americans to sit in your classroom and listen to you speak about our own history. Is that part of what you are exploring at Stanford?
I am at Stanford. I am affiliated with the Center for East European and Russian Studies. Mm-hmm. So when I'm here in the United States, people expect me to be an expert on Poland and all things Eastern Europeans are concerned with. But when I'm in the States, I'm actually here to learn more about your policies and American government's foreign policy. But right now, it's an interesting overlap of my interests and the story of the East Central European political exiles, because the American foreign policy, as you know, is being conducted by the State Department, is prepared in a country that is a democracy, which means it needs to be explained to the society, because every 2 years, you know, people in the House will be exchanged. Every 4 years, there will be a presidential election. So American government needs to explain its foreign policy agenda to the American public. And this is where the exiles came in handy. Hmm. These people who got here, they really wanted to be heard. Beware. Communists are not friendly people. You really cannot negotiate with them because they will violate every single agreement. President Truman realized it in the mid of 1946. You know, all of the agreements were basically violated. So when they got here, they wanted to be heard. They wanted to share their stories. And Americans realized that they really don't know, I'm talking about the foreign policymakers, that they don't really know much about East Central Europe. Hmm. They relied on some of the German intel that they were able to catch towards the end of the war. They had some of the Russia's experts, but that's not the same story, right? It's East Central Europe, you know, you need experts. So people who knew anything about the media, about economic system, political system, they were approached for information. But soon enough, the American government realized that should there be a global involvement confronting communism, you need to sell it. Mm. And then they sent the exiles all around the country to tell the story, what happened. So these folks were, you know, today we would call it a propaganda, but then they called it information with a purpose, okay? Just tell your story. It wasn't steered. It wasn't controlled like we in East Central Europe would understand propaganda, censorship, direction of news broadcast being, you know, sent from above. They were just asked to go out and tell their story to the audiences who had no idea. Okay, and when I'm at Stanford, there is a Hoover Institute, a library and archives located right there on the campus. And they have a collection not only of private papers of individual exiles, but they have records of Free Europe Committee. Free Europe Committee, our original National Committee for a Free Europe, was a parent organization to the Radio Free Europe that we spoke about a little bit earlier. And the corporate files, which include information, how the negotiations with the exiles were conducted, what kind of programs they were employed, because they were paid for it. Otherwise, they would have to go out and find jobs and forget about the whole thing. Many of the exiles would not accept American citizenship because they didn't want to lose the mandate to represent their compatriots. So they were totally vulnerable. Given the American support, they were able to become the voice of the silent people. And this was their mission. This was their job. So while at Stanford, I'm trying to look into the American state private network, because it was both the government and public foundations, NGOs or quangos, quasi non-governmental organizations. And I'm trying to find what was their relationship and how autonomous were they? And to what extent were they representative of the American foreign policy goals?
Yeah. And are we talking about exiles from Poland only or from other nations as well?
We are talking about exiles from nine East Central European countries, because for them, the American government prepared a separate program. So we are not talking about Russians. We are not talking about Ukrainians, whom the American government considered part of the empire. So they had different programs. We are not talking about peoples of Yugoslavia, former state of Yugoslavia, because for them, again, there was a different program that the American government ran. We are talking about the three Baltic countries turned into republics. They were forcibly annexed by the Soviet Union. Interestingly enough, as a side note, the American government continued to recognize their diplomatic representatives in the West throughout the entire Cold War. So Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania. Then, of course, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Albania. These were the nine countries that the American government considered East Central Europe. You know, you can look at this from two perspectives, Eastern Bloc, or the East Central Europe. The exiles were very clear on this one. We are not part of any bloc. We are not part of Soviet Union. We are countries of 100 million people who were forcibly incorporated into the system we don't want to be in.
And that's just it leaves us shaken to think about so many people enduring that kind of ordeal, and then the concerted effort over the course of so many years to shake off that domination, which eventually occurred. Let's talk for a moment about the close relationship between your university back in Gdańsk, Poland, and the University of Wisconsin Parkside, right up the road from us. And Anne, feel free to join in if you like, in terms of talking about this relationship. When did it begin and how did it begin?
We are passionate. I am passionate, okay? I think Anne, I can speak for both of us. To be here in Wisconsin, I'm just going to be very brief. To give you the large picture, Great Lakes is the area where many immigrants of Polish descent decided to settle. Because of the industries, because of the support, because of the community, Polish-American community in the United States. Nowadays, we think it's about 10 million people here in this country. Many of them still are here around the Great Lakes. So the University of Wisconsin at Parkside, being the center for our contact, it's an excellent hub to promote all things Polish. While the University of Gdańsk, where we have the American Studies Department, it's really a place where we desire contacts with American students who are coming to Poland, to Gdańsk, for summer study tours. Our cooperation started in 2012, and it would not have been possible had it not been for Anne.
So it's tell us, Anne, about that. How did this all begin from your perspective?
It was very interesting because Anya, which is her nickname, contacted me, and she said there are two young men in my office who want to come to the United States to study, and they are being sent to, or we're hearing about these small organizations that charge them $5,000 or $6,000 to find them a university. I said, wait, do I have a place for you? So I put them in touch with admissions at Parkside. And then I got an email a month later. They're on the plane on their way to Kenosha.
Wow.
And that's what and so they've done very well. They've graduated. One of them is still here in our pre-med program. He's going to medical school, Dominic Balkowski. I just messed. Well, I tried my best. And and then right after that, she said, let's try to see if we can move with a formal cooperative agreement. And she came here to speak, and Chancellor Ford and I met with Anya then, and then we worked on the agreement, and we had the first group of students come 2 or 3 years ago, I think. And then two groups of American students have gone to Poland under the direction of Professor Helen Rosenberg, who's a sociologist at Parkside. So that's how this got started. And I like meeting them. I pick them up at the airport. I like to take them out because I see them in August, and then I see them go back 4 months later, and vice versa. And I just was in Poland. I was entertained by our Polish students who were here a couple years ago, and they treat me like a complete idiot that I don't know anything. And they drive me around and they carry my luggage. And you know, when I talk to them compared to 2 or 3 years ago, it's a transformational experience for them and for our students, and it's really worthwhile doing, and I've just enjoyed it.
Very good. Tell us about the American students that come to Gdansk and what they typically experience there and how important it is for them.
Three major universities in Poland with a long tradition of American studies, well established. Gdansk is not one of them. Kraków, Warsaw, they are used to having American students. My students of the American studies program, they are really hungry for contact with their peers. Not all of them obviously can afford to come here to the United States to experience the culture. So the exchange program with Parkside really delivered the very unique American experience to my students. They were excited, awaiting the arrival of the American students. We have, with Professor Helen Rosenberg, we have designed a schedule which, you know, after arriving to Europe, allowed the American students to spend 5 days in Gdańsk and then move on to see the rest of the country, especially Warsaw with its beautiful museums, the Museum of the Warsaw Uprising, the Museum of the Polish Jews, and so on, and then go on to Kraków, see the Auschwitz, and then fly back to Chicago and back to Kenosha. So when they are in Gdansk for the 5 days, you know, getting rid of the jet lag, getting adjusted to the food, trying to learn, pick up some basic words, I made an arrangement with my students for their homestay. So that each and individual student, American student, would find a place with a Polish family. Mm. And this worked out wonders. Okay, this was a magnificent idea. They, you know, it's easy for people, you know, of similar age to become friends, very, very easy and fast. But it also provided them with a very unique cultural immersion. Not all of them had Polish roots. Not all of them were of Polish origin. So for some of them, this was really exotic. But I think all of them liked this, you know, private personal touch of this study tour. When they come to Gdańsk, they have an academic program. So they take classes. There are some lectures prepared by our faculty and staff. Of course, before they go to Poland, they have a prep course here with Professor Rosenberg and other teachers who do European.
Yeah, I lecture.
You do too,
yeah,
right?
I do a couple of them.
And then we travel in the region. So in Gdańsk, for example, we not only observe the history of the Hanseatic city. The first mention of Gdańsk is the year 997, when St. Adalbert is slaughtered by the Prussians, who were indigenous people in the area back in the 10th century. Then we go to see the Teutonic Knights Castle in Melberg, the UNESCO World Heritage site. Then we go to see the Mennonite houses that are right there in the Vistula Delta, because they were religious refugees who settled in Poland. And then when Poland was partitioned, this part became part of Prussia, they moved on to Russia, and some of them ended in America later on. So we have both the academic program, both the student-to-student one-on-one outreach, but we also do a lot of traveling. And that is fun, also because we get to try different Polish dishes, not as traditional pierogi and żurek, but also different styles of cooking, including the kaszub one, because we also go and I'm trying to, this is, you know, part of my private agenda, personal business, I'm trying to tell them a little story about what it means for an ethnic group to maintain its place and preserve its legacy and heritage against all the odds, like foreign domination, communist domination, popular culture, and so on.
Mm. You were saying before we went on the air that even though the American students are in Poland for a relatively short amount of time, that the emotional connection that is made is very, very powerful. And when it comes time to say goodbye, you can see it very clearly.
You know, it's such a delight to see these youngsters get to know and like each other so dearly. I know some of my students actually scheduled a summer tour, you know, in America together. I know they are still in touch. But it wasn't just the kids, you know, getting emotional at the station. I was too, you know. I had a wonderful time. And also Anne, Professor Gernak, as well as Professor Rosenberg. You know, I grew, and I'm delighted and honored to be able to call them my friends. Okay, mm-hmm. So it's been a wonderful, wonderful experience, beneficial to all. And I really look forward to having this continue over the next year. As long as I'm at the University of Gdańsk, you know, my heart beats in the rhythm of, you know, University of Parkside, Wisconsin Parkside.
So you will spend the rest of today speaking to several different classes at Parkside and talking, among other things, about this exchange program in the hopes that more Parkside students will take advantage of this. And then tonight at 6 o'clock in ComArts 131, you will be speaking about your most recent book and about other matters, and I assume you'll be entertaining questions from the audience and about anything that they might be interested in speaking to you about.
Definitely. So, you know, working on a book is like having another child. I have two already, and well, my children are big enough to attest to the fact that working on a book is a chore. I spent 2 years. Just, you know, writing down the material. It's a very lonely process, and you do not do it so that it would look nice on the library shelf. So I really look forward to the meeting tonight. I would gladly entertain all sorts of questions because it's the inspiration that I need for my future assignments, for my future projects.
Very good. Anne Mrzakiewicz is Associate Professor of History at the University of Gdańsk in Poland, but right now at Stanford as a Fulbright Senior Fellow doing further research. Her faculty hosts are one of them at Parkside, Anne Gernak, Professor Emeritus of Political Science. And again, we want to remind people that Professor Mrzakiewicz speaks at Parkside tonight to the public at 6 o'clock in the ComArts Room 131, a talk that is free and open to the public. And we invite people to come and be part of that. I thought we would finish out the hour by listening to just the last couple minutes of music of probably the most famous of all Polish musician, Ignaz Jan Paderewski, and his Fantasy Polonaise on original themes for piano and orchestra, a bit of Polish music to send everybody home. And in the meantime, I so appreciate Professor Mrzakiewicz, you making time in your schedule to visit us today on The Morning Show. It's very interesting, indeed delightful to speak with you, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me. And to all the listeners, I just want to say one final thing. NPR is available in Poland, and I do listen and appreciate the good job you are doing. So please support your local stations.
Ah, what a nice little announcement. Appreciate that. And Professor Anne Gernak, great to reconnect with you as well. Thank
nice
you so much.
Nice to be here again.
Thank you for making this possible.
Thank you.
It's a minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, something very different. We're going to be talking about the fan-generated web series called Star Trek Continues. This is a series that one can see on their website or on YouTube, and it features episodes in which painstaking care has been taken to recreate the visual look and spirit of Star Trek, the original series. The very final episode has just been released this morning. And tomorrow on the morning show, you'll hear my conversations with several different people involved in Star Trek Continues.